Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Hi listeners, Stuart here from Thrive Today. You know, many people tune in to a Thrive podcast every week. We're really encouraged by the feedback we receive on how these podcasts are impacting people's lives in very real ways and equipping them as they grow in their faith. Now, our hope and desire is to continue to make these podcasts available for free. However, there is a very real cost to make this happen. This is where you can help us. If you'd like to contribute to assist us in meeting these ongoing production and distribution costs, then please join our listener support program with a monthly subscription. Now, you can do this very quickly and simply. Just go to thrivetoday.tv, that's our website, thrivetoday, one word, .tv. At the top of the homepage, you'll see a button that says Donate. This will give you the option to support the Thrive podcast with a donation of $5 or $10 or $50 per month. You can set your own support level. So we hope you'll consider supporting this ministry in this way. Again, to those who are monthly supporters, a huge thank you to you. Your contribution is helping us continue to provide these Thrive podcasts for free. So it's easy. Visit thrivetoday.tv, click on the donate button. We thank you for your support by tuning in, but also by contributing financially in this way. Now let's jump into this episode of Thrive with Matt. Good morning, Matt. A bit of a rainy old day this morning.
It's great. I love it.
Yeah, I know
you do. Can you just feel those winter vibes, Stu?
Yeah, yeah. I've got my ski jacket on. In fact, I probably need to take my jacket off. It's going to get a bit warm in here. But
I went for a walk this morning, got completely soaking wet, just not used to the rain. You know.
Well, we haven't had rain like that in our part of the world for a long time, actually, really.
I was reading the other day why, but this is not an environmental podcast as such. I think today we turn over a new leaf.
We do. Well, kind of.
That's probably a bit too big.
I'm hoping I can turn over a new leaf anyway. But yes, you're right, Matt. Welcome, listeners. Thrive Deeper. And you recall our last episode, we kind of got to the gap in between the Old Testament and the New Testament. We talked about the intertestamental period. But Matt, we're actually going to go back to the Old Testament just for a short season for this next episode of Thrive and through the journey of the Thrive May, July edition, where we're going to be looking at the Wisdom Book or the Book of the Proverbs. Now, this is what's considered to be part of biblical wisdom literature, which is a collection probably of around about three books, being Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon.
The Book of Job, I'd put in there as well.
Good point.
And often the Book of Psalms is put in there.
Okay.
You know, I mean, Psalms tends to be a bit of a standalone in a way because it represents lots of aspects. But there is a strong wisdom stream throughout the Psalms. But Job, I would definitely put in there.
Yeah, no, that's a really good one. I did miss it. Spot on. Now, traditionally attributed a lot of them to King Solomon, although probably collected after, well after King Solomon. So probably the between 1600 BC, but possibly not collated until the post-exilic period. And there are also some teachings from other people and people groups, wisdom principles.
Which is really interesting.
Which is interesting.
Aspect
we'll talk
of the
a bit
Proverbs,
about that.
The fact that there are, you know, wisdom sayings drawn from non-Israelite kings, people like King Lemuel and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. And another guy then some other people we don't really know. And it would seem some similar to an Egyptian wisdom book, you know, as well, where there was this collective wisdom. But of course, we've also got to remember that King Solomon was considered to be the wisest man in the known world at the time. And many people came to him for wisdom. So they quite potentially took that wisdom back with them.
Right.
So the book is divided into sort of sections, and we'll talk a bit about that as we work through the book of Proverbs.
Which we're going to do in a slightly different way, aren't we, Stu?
Take us through that.
Well,
Matt.
I think the best way, because the Proverbs aren't organized in a sort of thematic fashion, really. So we're actually going to work with themes. And today, apart from just sort of generally introducing the book, we're going to talk about the theme, which actually is the theme of the first nine chapters of the book, which is the theme of wisdom, which is a really interesting theme because these wisdom books, they do function quite differently in a way, and particularly Proverbs functions differently, and it's important that we recognize that difference. Yeah. And so we're just going to talk about how – we're going to talk about wisdom as such, but also how this wisdom literature functions. So there's some interesting stuff today.
Fantastic. Yeah. One thing I think it's important to say, and we'll cover this probably in this episode, but the very first thing is it says wisdom begins with the fear of the Lord. And I think that gives kind of context to everything that follows.
Yeah.
But I think important to say too, perhaps, that the Proverbs are not promises, they're principles. And so when we read a proverb that says, do this and this will happen, that's not a promise. That's simply to say, the principle is, if we treat other people kindly, they're going to treat us kindly.
Which is one of the important differences. So it is different to, for example, the stuff that we find in the Torah or in the prophets and so forth.
Yeah.
These are not absolute statements. So, for example, it says in Proverbs 12:21, no harm befalls the righteous, but the wicked are filled with trouble. Now, one of the problems, of course, we have a whole book, the book of Job.
Which follows on.
Where serious harm befalls the righteous. And of course, it's the characters in the book of Job who are trying to apply this principle dogmatically. They're actually, interestingly, they're the ones that are depicted somewhat as the foolish ones, whereas Job is the one who essentially acquires wisdom. I mean, the book of Job is essentially someone who acquires wisdom through the fear of the Lord. He attains the fear of the Lord. He was a wise man, and he's, you know, he has wise friends, but there's a sense in which the wisdom of Job ends up transcending their wisdom because he attains the fear of the Lord. It's not a denial that there is genuine fragments of wisdom amongst those who don't know God, but this is, you know, the book of Job, I think, underscores, you know, this idea, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I mean, this is a good place to start, Stu, because this is the foundational principle, really, of wisdom. And in a sense, the fear of the Lord is the acknowledgement or the sort of connectedness with the fundamental aspect of reality, because the reality of God is the basis of all reality. And the fear of the Lord is something also that contrasts the biblical faith to the other faiths, because in a sense, the fear of the gods was a completely different, and well, any sense of that, I mean, there isn't really even a sort of a strong sense of that. It's in the pagan world, people were afraid of
the gods.
It wasn't the fear of the, you know, there wasn't really a sense of what, you know, in fact, they're not of such a nature that they would inspire awe. They're finite beings. I mean, they're very powerful finite beings. Character-wise, they certainly don't inspire awe, because they're always fighting with each other and various things like that. The fear of the Lord is the recognition that God infinitely transcends that.
It's all in wonder, really, isn't it? It's not fear as in I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Although there's an element of that, but that I'm afraid comes out of the awe and wonder of who God is.
Well, the analogy, Stu, that I would suggest is, you know, if you've ever climbed a mountain or something, and you stand on the edge of the mountain, you look down, you know, for example, I remember standing way up on a very high cliff, you know, facing out to the Southern Ocean down in Tasmania, you know, and just the elevation was unbelievable, and the scale of the landscape, and the heaving ocean, you know, just stretching out in all directions. And, you know, standing on the edge of that, it inspires this awe, but it is a kind of fear in the sense that this nature that I'm surrounded by is so, so powerful. It's way beyond anything that I can control. And there's something,
I think that's a great,
there's a marvelous insight in that, because we are in the grip of something that is infinitely beyond what we can grasp.
Yeah.
And also something that could within a moment snuff us out. So it's not a sense of a diminishment of significance, but it's being confronted with the vastness of nature.
Yeah,
you know, standing up over a cliff over the Southern Ocean.
Yeah.
Then it's definitely the case, you know, with God. And
I think that point about control, because I think we try to keep our lives in this place where we feel very much in control.
Yeah.
And it's not till we get to something and we look at it and we realize how really out of control we are compared to what's happening here.
Yeah.
You know, you read any of the accounts of astronauts that have been out into space and look back on Earth, and it's just completely changed their lives because of the awe and the wonder of the magnitude of what it is. You
know? There was actually, I mean, it was very, very significant moment for me in my spiritual growth when, you know, I mean, we've said, well, actually in our sister podcast, Thrive Perspectives, you know, we've I tried to discourage people chasing after big experiences, but occasionally God does something that has immense, you know, immense significance. And for me, this was actually was an encounter of God that was so overwhelming. It was like I was a point of infinite density, and it's like the whole, almost the whole universe converged, you know, on me, but something even greater than that, you know, and it was like I was this point of infinite density. And, it, you know, it was almost this sense of God just closing in from every side. And it just, my sense of being in the grasp of one who is so, whose power is so completely incomprehensibly, I mean, there are no words to even describe it. And the sense of wisdom coming from, I mean, I realized I am in the grip of something. There's no way that I could possibly comprehend the things of God. You know? And this is, you know, this is somewhat the experience that, I mean, Job very much has this experience, you know, the fear, like, surely I spoke of things I did not understand. He says, things too wonderful for me to know. Now that is Job, you know, acquiring wisdom. And so the fear of the Lord is absolutely still an adequate way, you know.
Totally.
But it's not scary. It's this
awe and wonder.
This awe and wonder. And in fact, and it's not from a distance either. It's actually inspired by, it's the intimate encounter with the transcendent greatness of God that inspires this. I mean, it says in Psalm 130, if you, O Lord, kept a record of sins, who could stand? But with you there is forgiveness. Therefore, he says, you are feared, right? Because there is forgiveness. And you think, why? Wouldn't the fear come from there being no forgiveness? You know, no, it's because actually forgiveness gives us access from the most intimate relationship with a great transcendent God. Yeah. And it's that combination of intimacy with transcendence that actually is this experience that we refer to as the fear of the Lord.
Yeah.
So I, you know, and there have been, you know, various times in my life where that sense has returned. And the only thing I can, again and again, the only thing that I can compare it to is that sense of standing on the edge of a mountain, and it's awe-inspiring, right? You're filled with joy and wonder, right? And yet, man, you hold on tight.
Yeah.
There's this sense of God saying, you don't ever let go of me. Yeah. Don't ever let go of me. So it's not scary run away from God. It's a fear that compels you to hold on to God for your life, for your eternal life.
It's great.
So, you know, I think this, because it's there, it's, you know, a number of times through the book of Proverbs, you know, it comes back to this idea, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, because this frames everything.
Yeah, it gives perspective.
It's this reality that frames everything. Yeah. Now, the next step from this is this sense that, you know, it's interesting because the Proverbs, as you say, the Proverbs functions differently to other parts of Scripture where we have a more direct address of God.
Well, I was going to ask you that about the book of Proverbs because, you know, as we read through them, we recognize these are a collection of sayings from men who have perhaps discovered that through life experience, through their perspective, and obviously to some degree, I guess, for them, personal revelation. But it seems odd that this book of kind of sayings of principles, you know, ended up as part of Scripture.
Yeah. So this is an important point, actually. There is a sense in which Proverbs, because it's interesting, there is no, God is always referred to as God Elohim in the sort of generic sense. There's no mention of the land. When the king, when it refers to the king, it's not the king, it's a king's, just generally, you know. Yeah. So it doesn't seem to be, like there's no mention of sacrifice, temple sacrifices, you know, it's the wisdom of, for example, the Proverbs is very much based in the created order. It is what theologians describe as general revelation. It's like the best of general revelation. Now, there are key foundational elements that are built in special revelation, but Proverbs, in a sense, has reference mainly to God's created order because it is through wisdom that the created order exists. Like the created order, and this is the sense you get from, you know, Proverbs chapter 8, for example, is the sense that the created order is the very direct expression of wisdom. Now, later on and in the Greek period, the word logos, it starts being used. And amongst the Hebrew thinkers actually picked this idea up, and it's picked up in the first chapter of John's gospel. In the beginning was, and now we translate it word, But it's in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. So in Proverbs chapter 8, it makes a big deal of that God creating through wisdom. He creates through wisdom, right? And in fact, throughout the first 9 chapters of the book of Proverbs, wisdom is personified. Wisdom cries out. Wisdom is a street preacher, crying out and beckoning us to. Wisdom is in a sense, not just something, but someone that we follow. And so there's this sense that the created order is in some sense the incarnation of reason, in that sense. Now, of course, in a very special sense, Jesus becomes the in flesh is the Logos, yes. is the embodiment of wisdom. I think when the book of Proverbs is speaking, personifying wisdom, I think it's doing it in a more figurative sort of way, but certainly the idea there that, that the earth is created through wisdom in a very important sense is why you get this very general sort of idea. And I think why the nature of wisdom literature is different, because this is about how things work normally.
I was just going to say, would it be fair to say that the way Proverbs is written is it's the practical application of the creation order?
That's right.
That God created.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. So, we see God's wisdom, for example, but next time you watch these nature documentaries and, about science and cells and, I mean, all of this incredible stuff, like life, the building blocks of life and DNA and, oh my word, we should have awe.
Yeah, totally. Our
response should be one of awe. Absolutely. And because according to the Proverbs, this is an expression of the wisdom of God in the way that all things are made, And so to exercise wisdom is in some ways to participate in this wisdom that is in all things and is very much connected with the way that things normally work. Now, wisdom, however, is also present when things break down and there's chaos. Wisdom is also something that we need to work out what is the right decision when things do go completely wrong. Right now, Job is a classic, example, but there's also the sense in which it's those tough ethical decisions that people tend to try to go looking for, for laws or rules and so forth to work out, what should I do in this sort of situation? Yeah. And of course, there are some situations in life that are so complex, so morally complex, where the situation is so complex and so chaotic and it's such a tangle, you can't just apply a rule to it. Need to exercise wisdom, right? You need to exercise wisdom. Now, wisdom recognizes there's a sense in which wisdom is able to prioritize things, theologians spoke about a sort of hierarchy of being, this sort of sense of, and Augustine, for example, Augustine's definition of evil is the disordering of God's hierarchy of goods, so there's a sense in which wisdom is able to prioritize things as well. It's a very practical sort of thing. So it's interesting that even artisans in the Old Testament. So, for example, the people that constructed the temple were seen to have a kind of wisdom. There's a kind of wisdom in ruling, in administration. There's a kind of wisdom. It's a very broad. It's a very broad concept. And I think the common element here is this sense of bringing of order.
Yeah.
So it's essentially what we see in Genesis chapter 1 is God bringing order to the chaos, and the creation that we end up with is this direct expression of the wisdom of God. And so in some ways, anyone that can do that in any sort of field is seen to have a kind of wisdom, because you're bringing order to what might otherwise be chaos. And so, as I was saying, there's this sense in which even in the midst of chaos, it gives us the ability to prioritize what is the most, what is the most important thing here. And so it's being discriminating in the right sort of sense, discriminating between the right and the wrong thing for a particular situation. Know what I mean? Not just the right and the wrong thing in terms of applying a rule, but what is actually the best thing here to achieve the right outcome or to reflect what God wants to be and do in this situation. Situation. Mm. So it has that breadth to it. And of course, this is, you know, why, as we were saying before, it's important that we don't take these as promises as such, you know, when it says these things. And so when, you know, no harm will befall the righteous, but the wicked are filled with trouble, as the proverb says, you know, this is a way that things, you know, the way that things normatively sort of work, but there are situations where great harm befalls the righteous. In fact, Jesus makes a very big deal of the fact that his people are going to suffer harm. Yeah. I mean, in a sense, but that doesn't make it good. See, here's the thing. It's not that it's a good thing, that it's just this sort of inevitable, it's an inevitable thing,
part of God's overall order.
That's right.
Yeah. In creation.
But there's also the recognition of then, of also what counts as ultimate harm as well. You know what I mean? Right. It's in wisdom that we recognize, you know, Jesus says, do not fear those who can kill the body, but only fear the one who can, you know, destroy both body and soul in hell. That is a classic, that's a sort of classic wisdom kind of saying in a sense, because it's about prioritizing. It's this recognition that for the sake of your soul, it may be that, you know, the body may be harmed for the sake of the soul in a sense.
Yes.
And so the martyrs of the church, you know, lay this foundation for the salvation of the world in many, many respects. And so in the wisdom of God, God allows for this. And of course, it doesn't mean that everything that every bad thing that happens is good, or that we need to try to find a reason for it. That also is not a wise thing to do. This idea to say to someone, oh no, there must be a reason for this. That's like Job's friends, right? So we have all of these examples of what wisdom looks like, because the world as it is, the world system is chaotic, right? Yeah. It's not working the way that it should. And wisdom even recognizes that, right? Yeah. But also, you know, recognize what we can do about it. So
the Job ones are great. Job ones are great. And we're not talking about Job today, but anyway, just want to say this.
No, it's very relevant because it is, it demonstrates the getting of wisdom.
Because if you read Job, well, for me, as I read Job, you kind of go, well, that kind of makes sense what those guys are saying.
You know,
it's like, it's not really till the end that you realize, actually, no, that wasn't a good thing. And so this is a great place to sort of start with the fear of the Lord. And I think giving us perspective and recognizing that there's a much bigger thing here, and it's not just about our little set of circumstances, but also recognizing that we can pray into our circumstances and God can act and will act in according to his will and his purpose, you know. Yeah. So, but yeah, it's interesting because, you know, we could all, oh yeah, that makes sense, that makes sense. But if you actually read through the book of Job, and the first guys, when they, you're kind of going, oh yeah, well, that's probably worth
it. And that's the thing about wisdom. It's much more nuanced than that.
Yeah,
it recognizes the complexity of life, but it recognizes what we can't know and can't grasp, and that ultimately is where, you know, is what Job discovers in the end, in the light of the infinite magnitude of
and the fear of the Lord.
That's in the fear of the Lord,
which is where this begins.
And look, you know, one of the things I love about this perspective on wisdom and being very much rooted in the created order is this recognition that God reveals himself in that created order, and it creates this invitation for us to find the wisdom of God in creation.
Yes.
Not just an aesthetic experience of, oh, isn't it beautiful, inspiring, or, but to actually read off of nature the wisdom of God. I mean, Jesus uses parables, you know, of seed becoming the tree and so forth. And parables in a way, look, parables are very prophetic, but they're kind of
proverbs as well.
Yeah, they're proverbial in a sense as well. They're sort of kind of long proverbs. And you know, and a lot of that is reading off nature. You know, it's telling stories about the way that things work. Jesus saying, look, you know, there was a landowner who does such a, you know, because this is the way that the world works, right?
Yeah.
And
build your house on the sand.
Yeah, that's right.
Build your house on the rock. This is what's going to happen.
Yeah. You know? So there's a lot of this wisdom genre actually in the teaching of Christ. There is a lot of it in Paul, and you know, James, of course, the book of James is seen to be really the wisdom book of the New Testament. But the book, of course, that's most well known for this is the book of Proverbs, of course, because it has these axioms that we and
do this and this will happen, do that and that will happen.
Yeah, that's right. So it's these axioms. One common definition of wisdom that I read is the skill of living well. You know, it's the skill of living well. So there is an element of skill to it, because there's something very practical about this wisdom. It's not just a sort of esoteric, very theoretical. In a sense, it becomes a little bit more like that as we move into the Greek period. But because it's a skill, it's this skill of living well, it's acquired through experience. It's taught. There's a lot here about, you know, throughout the first nine chapters, clearly exhortations of an older man to a younger man, you know, yes. My son, you know, heed my teaching and so forth. And so there's this connection then with wisdom and experience and age. And I think this is a really important point, Stu, particularly for our culture, because we put a lot of emphasis in our culture on youth, on the original, the drive, the new,
energy
of youth. That's right, and the energy of youth and the sort of entrepreneurial youth kind of thing, right? Mm. And even churches can. I mean, churches can put a lot of emphasis. Now, of course, churches need to emphasize, you know, we need to emphasize the younger generations in the sense that they are the future of the church, right? Yeah. And certainly the ministry of the church needs to be definitely, yes, absolutely needs to be oriented, towards, you know, the future generations. However, there's this sort of idea too, is that you retire off all the older people and
kind of get them out of the way.
And therefore you have, you can have churches with, you know, people sort of over 60 and 70 years old, thinking, oh, I'm out to pasture now. I don't really have a role in the church. Whereas actually, according to this wisdom literature, in fact, probably the most vital role is played by the older people in the sense that there is a wisdom that we desperately need.
That's been learnt from experience.
That's been learnt from experience. Now, that doesn't mean that just because, you know, it doesn't mean that every old person necessarily has wisdom. But someone that has walked with God and has grown in their faith over decades and decades becomes this sort of container of the riches of God and the riches of God's wisdom. The last thing you want to do is just retire that off. And that actually, you know, and any of our listeners who are perhaps feeling, you know, like, oh, I don't really have a role in the church. I mean, absolutely the opposite. I think, you know, the more experience you have, even actually experiences of making errors,
we've all learned from error.
That's
really
right.
At the end of the day, you know, very few of us get things right the very first time
that's
we do
right.
it, whether
even
it's
if
riding
you've
a bike.
The hard way, yeah.
Exactly.
If you look back and you see a sort of litany of errors, I mean, there is something that you have out, there is wisdom out of that you can
I think
impart.
A great example of that, and it's probably a little bit of a basic one, but as a parent, you know, there are things you tell your kids, don't do that because you know that that's not a good thing to do. They think it's fine, but you're going, no, that's not going to end well. And it's not until they go through that experience, but without you sowing in that and saying, hey, I'd reconsider that. I don't know that that's a good idea because you've learned through that process, you know.
And
you've been able to observe others of your peer group going through that situation and you're able to provide that advice.
And this is why, Stu, I think, I mean, we won't get too much into this issue, but I think in the light of this, it is an important point to make, is that, you know, contemporary churches, I think, are always in danger of becoming shallow when we alienate the wisdom of years.
Yeah.
And, you know, churches can become very pragmatic and be very sort of style-oriented and lose a depth that can only come through experience, you know, and a sense of continuity even with the past, you know, because it's all about the latest and the, I mean, the Christian movement is so much about continuity. We're building on 2,000 years of experience here. And so, you know, I mean, look, I mean, there's some churches that almost completely retire off their older, and even the elders in the church are sort of under 50, you know, and it's like, what? I mean, elders are called elders because they were old, because it's, you know, the idea of an elder is based in this idea that there's a certain wisdom that can only come with years. And it's a wisdom that the church always needs, because it's not about strategy and eldership in its true sense is about this sort of oversight. You know, it's about oversight, right? It's not about controlling everything. And this is where this goes. This is where this often can go badly, right? Because, you know, elders try and control and keep it. And it's all about nostalgia and keeping things the old way. And no. It's this oversight that is constantly feeding this depth of wisdom into the church. And I think, I mean, I believe our church is so incredibly blessed by a group. This has been very, you know, intentional. We've built a group of elders that really carry this wisdom and this depth. You know, I think that flows out into the church. And there's a level of elevation. You know, they're not involved in strategy. We've got a great young and vibrant team. They're involved in this, but let's never, ever neglect the wisdom of age.
It's great. I was going to say, and I'm kind of reluctant now, given that's such a great landing point, but I feel also one of the dangers for us, not just in the church, but in life as well, is to not recognize that sometimes wisdom is counterculture.
And, it is, yeah.
And culture would tell us we need to meet people where the culture is at.
Yeah.
But actually, sometimes we actually need to do the exact opposite.
We actually
need to slow things down. We need to go, no, we're not going to entertain you, or we're not going to, you know, this is a different thing we're doing here.
And that's a great point. And even the decision, and in what sense do we conform with our culture, and in what sense are we countercultural?
Yeah.
That is a wisdom decision, right? Because you can be counterculture in all the wrong ways.
Yeah,
okay?
Spot on.
You know, you can become unintelligible to your culture and create cultural obstacles. Mm. You know, and that's a matter for wisdom. Okay, so in what sense are we the same? You know, Paul says, I have become all things to all men so that I might win some, right? I mean, he knew when he needed to conform so that the message stands out.
Yes.
Like, if they're going to be offended, let them be offended at the claim of Christ.
And yes.
It's like not by the way that we do things or the way that we dress things up.
But that's using the culture to achieve something rather than becoming.
That's right.
Culture.
And this is a matter of wisdom, Stu. This is why we need wisdom. You know, I mean, one of the other things that I will always remember, and in some ways, Stu, those first nine chapters of the book of Proverbs have been deeply, deeply impacting for me. I remember when I was at theological college, you know, back in the 90s, and I was really caught by these early chapters, and I because I was acquiring lots of knowledge, but God kept through these chapters kept pointing me to wisdom. You need wisdom, right? You need wisdom.
Yeah.
And
because those are different things.
Yeah. And
knowledge and wisdom.
And I remember things, that's right. Yeah, you know, and of course
wisdom is actually how to use knowledge.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's an important point, because we need knowledge, and you know, also, you know, Proverbs also talk a lot about knowledge and having knowledge and so forth. But yeah, utilizing the knowledge that we have is a point of wisdom. But I can remember reading these chapters. I remember there's this one part, I think it's in chapter 4, where it says, get wisdom, though it cost you all that you have, get wisdom.
Mm.
You know, it says elsewhere that it's more precious than rubies, more precious than gold. You know, get wisdom, though it cost you all you have. And I had this sense that actually it probably was going to cost me all that. Actually, it was inevitably going to be costly.
Mm.
You know, I could feel that as I prayed for it. It's like, you know, God was saying to me, do you really want this? Because it's really going to cost you something.
Yeah.
And when I think back and I think all of the ways that God has imparted wisdom into my life, it has been costly.
Yeah.
It's been through experiences that I didn't want to go through, that I, you know, it's this, you know, I mean, we see this with Job, and of course I've not gone through anything like what Job went through, but Job got wisdom in the end, and it cost him all that he had, you know. And I think that point about the costliness of wisdom, you know, as well, that sometimes things need to get stripped away, and it's a very holistic thing. It's not just facts in your head.
No, that's right.
Wisdom is deeply, deeply experiential, and sometimes the gaining of wisdom means that so much gets stripped away in a very deep and existential sense.
Yeah, totally. And my experience would be the same. I've learnt the most through mistakes that either I've made or situations that I've been put into that I would much rather not have been put into, but I come out the other side of it going, man, I learnt so much through that.
Yeah.
And that's what gives wisdom for when you can help others through a similar situation or when you find yourself in that place again. So, you know, having that perspective again with the fear of the Lord, understanding it, at the end of the day, wisdom comes from him in the sense of his order, but we can apply it in our lives through some of these principles, not promises that we see in the book of Proverbs.
Yeah, that's right. And Stu, you know, I think today in the complex world in which we live, we really need Christians with wisdom more than ever. I mean, this is a very difficult world to, you know, to navigate. And just having knowledge, I mean, look, that's important. Understanding what you believe is absolutely important.
Yeah.
You know, wisdom needs something to wield, right? Wisdom needs a sword to wield, right? Wisdom is the skill of wielding the sword. And I'm using the sword because, of course, in Ephesians chapter 6, Paul famously says the sword of the Spirit is the word of God, right?
Yes.
And if we don't have you know, a really thorough knowledge of the scriptures, we're in the battle without a sword, right? Yeah. But it's no use being in the battle with a sword when you also don't know how to use the sword, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, knowledge can be used in ways that can be damaging if we don't have wisdom. And so, you know, particularly, I think in our world today, it's the wisdom to navigate through the complexities. It's the wisdom to weigh up all of the things, to prioritize things. There are lots of facts about the world. There's lots of sort of data that we, you know, we live in the age of information. Actually, now we live in the age of disinformation. So, you know, discernment, I think, I mean, with people just getting drawn into these sort of bizarre conspiracy theories, there's a need for discernment, you know, even a need for a bit of basic critical thinking as well. I'll put my plug in for, you know, because philosophy of which there is, that, you know, we see the application, for example, in Paul, and is in a sense the application of critical thinking, and there's a skill element to that as well. So there is a skill element to wisdom. Wisdom is not just something that is just super, some ethereal supernatural thing. It comes through training and instruction, right? So there is a emphasis in the book of Proverbs in training and instruction.
Yeah.
And it's not just the receiving of facts. It's about how things work, and it's about how to think critically as well. So in a sense, there's a lot in the book of Proverbs that are exercises in critical thinking. And actually for in the Greek period, you know, the Greek word for wisdom is sophos, you know, and phileo is the Greek word for love. So philosophy is, yep, you know, the love of wisdom. I mean, look, when they do metaphysics, that, you know, they don't get it completely wrong. I mean, remarkably, they actually get a lot right by through general revelation. Yeah. This is the remarkable thing. Through thinking critically and using reason rightly, it's amazing what they got right, actually. Mm. And the early church definitely recognized this and took, you know, a lot of those critical thinking skills, you know, and Aristotle talked about a lot about the right use of reason and logic and so forth. And that was recognized and utilized within theological just all the distinctions and, yeah, you know, it was well utilized by the early church because they recognized that is important wisdom, right? It's training or instruction in thinking critically as well, and being discerning and understanding the right distinctions and so forth. And it was the application of that, really, that, I mean, a lot of the formation of Christian theology, the content of which is biblical. But there was so much need for wisdom in those early stages because there were many people in the early church that wanted to make it all logical, and the black early church and white fathers just kinda kept, yeah, yeah, the black and white, you know, and wanted to, you know, make all the gray areas black and white, wanted to get rid of paradoxes. And you know, I think in the wisdom of the church fathers, they said, no, we need to recognize that there is a limit to reason and we need to know what we can't know. And so, you know, they also recognize where the edges are as well.
Yeah.
So I think in our day, getting back to my point, of you know, of all of this information that's thrown out of us, you know, facts as well as fiction, we need more than ever to think discerningly, to be good critical thinkers, and attain the skill of wisdom as well. You know,
yeah.
So there is. I mean, it's interesting that Paul talks about a gift of wisdom in, you know, in 1 Corinthians,
yes,
chapter 12, and so, you know, I think there is a gift. There is a gift of wisdom. It's, you know, like that perspective and that particular sense of being equipped, even with those, you know, with those skills. But there's still something that to be learned. And it's just like, you know, Paul also talks about the gift of faith, right? Now, we all need to have faith.
Yes.
But there are some people that have a gift of faith. They're given a special measure of faith for certain sorts of things. And there are some people who are given a special portion of wisdom for a particular purpose. And of course, Solomon is one of these,
yes,
people,
yeah,
right? Because he's, you know, he's a leader and there's a special sense in which he needs wisdom
And Solomon prayed that prayer you said before that was the dangerous prayer to pray, because he said, you know, God said to him, what is the one thing that you want?
Yeah.
You know, and he said, I want wisdom to govern over your people, kind of
That's
thing.
That's right.
And God gave it to him.
God gave it to him. And, you know, but there's something, and here again, an encouragement to all of those that feel, as they look back in their lives, that they see just too many mistakes.
Mm.
Solomon gained wisdom at the start. God gave him wisdom, but he also gained wisdom the hard way as well.
Yeah.
And in a sense, the book of Ecclesiastes, yes, represents the wisdom that Solomon got the hard way, right? Yeah. He made all the mistakes and he learnt from that, you know. And Ecclesiastes, whether or not it's written actually by Solomon or not, I'm inclined to think certainly has a Solomonic origin. It certainly reflects what Solomon learned through those experiences of getting a whole lot of things wrong. And so even if you've got a whole lot of things wrong, if you learn from that, you can be better off.
Yeah. And I think that's where wisdom often comes from too, is like, you know, the fact that we need to be able to reflect. And I think that's probably something in this modern age we don't do as much as perhaps we should, is reflect back on what went well with that or what didn't go well with that, whether it's a meeting, whether it's a family, you know, situation, whatever it might be, is actually taking the time out to go, okay, how could I have approached that differently?
Yeah, that's right.
Because that's what then brings wisdom to the next situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, a big part of wisdom is knowing what you don't know as well. This is a very important theme. So I remember saying to someone when I was 16, you know, I reckon I know it all. I mean, I just thought it's amazing.
Took you till 16, man, I knew it all at 12.
Yeah, that's right. You just think you know. You just think you know it all, you know. Yeah. And I mean, I probably was being facetious, but I think deep down, you know, there was a sense of with the getting of wisdom, you become more sensitive to what you don't know. I mean, I think people who acquire a lot of knowledge and wisdom in a certain area are often far humbler about even what they know about that area, you know, and definitely more humble about what they know about other things. So one of the problems I think today, getting back to the, you know, that sort of conspiracy theories thing and how polarized people are over opinions, one of the problems there is the level of certitude that people feel that they have, you know what I mean? And often the comment that I make is not arguing about whether or not what they're claiming to be true is true. It's essentially helping them to see that there's no way that they can know that with the certitude that they think that they have, right?
Yeah.
At least not enough certitude to be, you know, placarding on about that.
Belligerent about
that. Yeah, and being so belligerent about them. You have to have so much certainty. Mm. And there are just some things, it's impossible to even have that much certainty about that. Certainly not if you lack expertise, you know, about that. And there's a bit of a, you know, there's this bit of a swing against, you know, experts. But, you know, expertise is something as Christians that we should value, right?
Yes.
And we certainly should have the humility to know what we don't know and to be able to say, I don't know. I think one of the wisest things you can say is, well, I think it could be this, but I really don't know. Recognizing the limits of what it's possible for you to know, what it's possible for you to think critically about. I mean, as I have gotten older and as I learn more, as I gain more experience, I find myself more and more saying, yeah, I actually don't know. I have convictions with all of the major elements that are clear in Scripture. I have solid convictions about those things, and my life is grounded on that rock. But in all the gray areas, I've more and more been inclined to be willing to say, actually, I don't know, or I'm not sure. I would commend that. And certainly the book of Proverbs does as an expression of wisdom. So let me finish with the exhortation. I encourage readers actually to go to those exhortations. Don't just say, oh, yeah, when you're reading these long sections that talk about get wisdom, talk about how valuable it is, right? And they're saying that because it's going to cost you a lot to get wisdom, because it's something you should pray for God to give you, right? You should earnestly desire wisdom. You know, in fact, in James, that famous thing, you know, you do not have because you do not ask, that actually is applied in the case of wisdom. If anyone lacks wisdom, he should ask God who gives, you know, ask for wisdom. What we're told in the New Testament, that we should pray and ask God for wisdom. We should seek wisdom through the acquisition of skill. We should learn to think critically. We should acquire a really good knowledge of the Scriptures. But most of all, we should learn to fear the Lord. We should learn to know God, not just as a theory, but deepen our experiential knowledge of who God is. That is the beginning of everything.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.